Ophira Eisenberg on the next Ask Me Another. Game on. Save tomorrow
for tomorrow. Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Nigeria has been in the news a lot lately. That's since the militant Islamic organization Boko Haram kidnapped hundreds of schoolgirls on April 15th. Professed to be against Western education, Boko Haram took the girls away from their books and their teachers and have threatened to sell them as wives and slaves. Over the last 2 years, the World Bank Group has researched the role that education plays in the lives of women and girls around the world. And their report was published yesterday. It highlights their findings. Joining us to explain is Jenny Klugman. She's the Director of Gender and Development at the World Bank Group, and she's with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Also with me here is Lucia Hanmer. She's lead economist in the Gender and Development Unit at the World Bank Group, also joining me. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jenny, we get new reports about women and girls all the time, right? So what is so special about this one?
Well, I think this is special not only because of the timing. As you mentioned, the tragedy which is unfolding in Nigeria, I think, underlines the urgency, the agenda. But the issues that we're dealing with in this report are about the denial of choice. Girls who are unable to go to school, girls who are unable to make choices about whether and how many children to have, whether or not to get married, unable to own or inherit land, unable to make decisions at home. So I think bringing together the evidence from around the world about the gravity of these challenges and also what can be done, I think makes it very timely as well as new.
Which is obviously a topic that the UN would be interested in, but the World Bank and you as an economist, Lucia, why is this an economic issue?
Well, Celeste, when you see how the difference that it makes when women get educated
economically
to their lives, to their families, educated women can produce more in agricultural areas. Even really poor women in subsistence farming, once they get educated, they know how to use fertilizers, how to use seeds, where to go for information. It makes a massive difference economically to women, their families, and their futures.
So a word that gets used a lot is agency. Jenny, you talk about the importance of expanding women's agency. What exactly does that mean?
Well, agency is about people being able to make decisions that matter to them, to their families, the communities in their countries. And it relates to, for example, having say over whether and how many children to have, being able to own land, being able to participate in public life. So it's very much about decision-making and capability to make and pursue decisions.
So give me a story, Lucia, that kind of explains what you're talking about here. Is there any specific example that comes to mind?
Yes, the benefits of education and getting girls into school. When I was in Zimbabwe, I did research, and I went to the field with a translator to ask women farmers what they needed, what inputs they needed, how their families were doing. I came back 10 years later with the translator to see how they were doing, and those women could speak English. They could understand. They were shown as speaking. They hoed the fields with a handheld hoe, but they could understand what I was there, and they could speak. And we find in our report, when we ask girls the difference between their lives and their mother's life, education comes top. They say it gives us a voice. We can be heard. We have views. We matter.
We have to talk about men and boys every time we have this conversation about educating women. When Michelle Martin spoke to Malala Yousafzai and her father, Ziauddin, last October, he said, her father, he was often asked what special training he gave to his daughter, and here's what he said.
I usually tell people, you should not ask me what I have done, rather you ask me what I did not do, which is usually done by parents. I did not clip her wings to fly. And I always give a message to the parents all around the world where girls are suffering. Trust your daughters. They are faithful. Honor your daughters. They are honorable. And educate your daughters. They are amazing.
So he, though, is an outlier. I mean, he's an exception to a cultural rule in many of these places. How do you get past, Jenny, these attitudes, which are often cultural and very traditional among fathers and husbands, that education is not necessary for women, that in fact sometimes it's an evil?
We're learning a lot about what matters, and part of the answer is around the expansion of economic opportunity. So we see in Bangladesh, another Muslim-majority country, that the expansion of women's economic opportunities led to huge increases in girls' enrollment in schools, and norms changing over time with, I think, the realization of the economic value of education. We also see in other areas working with community elders, working with religious leaders, and starting young with boys is very important. And there's, I think, good evidence now from around the world, from Brazil, working in slums, from Burundi and Malawi, about the importance of bringing together programs which target directly boys and men, because although we're interested in improving the outcomes for girls and women, working only with girls and women is very unlikely to bring the results that we're looking for.
If you're just joining us, the voice you just heard is Jenny Klugman. She's Director of Gender and Development at the World Bank Group. And also with me is Lucia Hanmer. She's Lead Economist in the Gender and Development Unit at the World Bank Group. The World Bank Group just published a report yesterday that's dealing with the effect that education has, not just on the lives of women and girls, but also, Lucia, on the economies of the countries where those women and girls reside. And I wanted to kind of get into that more because, you know, often many countries say they simply don't have the funds necessary to educate every child in their country. What response do you have to that?
Well, Celeste, it's not that expensive. The World Bank has done some programs in Cambodia to see what it would take to get the poorest children into school. And $45 is what it takes.
This $45 per
annum.
Per girl,
year? Yes.
$45 a year?
To the family for a scholarship, for the family to allow the parents to buy school uniforms, to help with the costs of having a child in school. So for the poorest, it is not very expensive.
Although, I mean, since, Jenny, we're talking about what's some of the later developments, and we've also mentioned Malala. She, of course, became famous because she was shot by extremists, and these girls in Nigeria were kidnapped by extremists. How do you get past the fear, perhaps, in some parents' minds that by sending their girls to school in countries like this, they're making them a target?
I think the horror of these tragedies are almost incomprehensible for those of us sitting in Washington, D.C. What we try and do is appeal to the universal nature of the values that we're talking about. And I think that the clip that you played from Malala's father, I think, gets at the humanity of the decisions. And I think in most cases that having a conversation with individuals about their daughters and about the aspirations for their daughters would kind of reveal, I think, the importance of thinking about, you know, women, girls as people, boys as people, and I think our universal humanity. And working with, I think, local leaders, with religious leaders, the vast majority of whom are moderate, is going to be the long-term way to be able to enable change and to avoid the risks which are being incurred by these extremist minority groups in some parts of the world.
One of the responses I've seen, Lucia, to this particular report from the World Bank is that now we finally have these numbers we've been waiting for. What are the numbers here that kind of connect education for girls to the economic growth of a country? Can we actually make connect those dots?
Not in a straightforward line, but I think what you have are general impacts on productivity in terms of more education. We know that if more women were in the labor force, this would increase GDP of the country overall from a range of between 5 and 10%, depending on the country. So it makes a huge difference.
I would also add that it's important to be thinking about development not just in income terms. And so what we document in terms of the gains from education is it enables girls to say no to sex. It enables girls to avoid child marriage. It enables girls to avoid violence when they become women. And these are very powerful and direct effects which are associated with higher levels of education. So we do systematic comparisons of girls who only have primary level education to those who have finished secondary school and those who have university education. And around the world, the differences are striking, and they're showing really major impacts in terms of girls' and women's lives and the lives of their families. So the gains in terms of income are important, but I think the broader gains are very important as well.
And how significant is it that the World Bank is looking at what, at heart, is really a human rights issue?
I think it's important, but it's central to development. I think it's the recognition that development is more than about income. which I think is being much more broadly recognised around the world, and that we're concerned about kind of health and education and well-being more broadly, I think is very important. The World Bank is not a rights-based organisation.
Right, exactly.
It's an organisation which is bringing development, but I think it's important not to overplay the differences. The synergies, I think, are very large. And so what we argue in the report is that the rights-based case is important, and it's one to which 188 countries or 188 states around the world have signed up to in the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, but it's also one which will bring development gains more broadly.
Well, we only have about a minute left, but Lucia, do you expect the report to be persuasive? I mean, in some of these countries, I expect this is a difficult argument.
Yes, but I think, as Jenny says, there are a wide range of gains from educating women. For example, women who are educated have a much lower chance of one-year-old children being stunted in their growth. So their education feeds through into their ability to make choices for their children that are good for them and good for the future. Now, this has to be persuasive for society overall.
One would hope, anyway. Lucia Hanmer, lead economist in the Gender and Development Unit at the World Bank Group. Jenny Klugman is also in that unit at the World Bank as well. Thank you both so much for joining us. And this report is available online.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, many national parks showcase American history, but they often leave out the more complicated African-American story. Not on Park Ranger Betty Reed Soskin's watch, though.
What gets remembered is a function of who's in the room doing the remembering. And I'm the only person in the room who had any reason to remember that.
She shares, get ready, 9 decades of wisdom from segregation during World War II to blogging at 92. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Coming up on the next Here and Now, building a library of 3D hearts.
If you have a med student that's got a friend that's got a 3D printer, he can say, hey, can you print this file for me? I'm really struggling with this. Or a family that says, you know, our nephew has this. Let's see if we can find this online and print it out.
Join me, Jason Croft, for that story and more on Here and Now weekdays starting at noon here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Friends of WILL and from Urbana's Market at the Square, happening every Saturday morning, rain or shine, from 7 a.m. to noon at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in historic downtown Urbana. Learn more at urbanaillinois.us/market.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. Now it's time for our Wisdom Watch. That's where we talk to people who've made a difference through their lives and their work. Joining us today is Betty Reed Soskin. At 92, she's the oldest national park ranger in the United States. During World War II, she worked for an all-black boilermakers union in Richmond, California, and she brings that history and much, much more to her current job as a ranger at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park. She joins us now from Berkeley, California. Betty, welcome. Such a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
Let's go back to your days during World War II, and Rosie the Riveter often is the first thing that comes to mind when people talk about working women during that time. But you reject that title, Rosie the Riveter. Why?
Well, that really is a white woman's story. Black women were not emancipated by the Second World War. We were working since slavery outside our homes. And so I have never, I never did see, for instance, a ship under construction during that period. I was going in a carpool every day to Richmond from Berkeley, working in a Jim Crow segregated Boilermakers Auxiliary 36 because the unions were not yet racially integrated. And going home every night without having any sense of what that greater picture was. So Rosie the Riveter simply never did appeal to me as something to identify with.
So you are an interpretive ranger there. And what what story do you tell them when visitors come to the Rosie the Riveter site?
I stay pretty much with my own story because I think all the elements are there. If you go back to my timeline, my great-grandmother was born into slavery in 1846. She was freed by the Emancipation Proclamation. She was born in St. James Parish, Louisiana. She lived to be 102, which means that she died 3 years after the Second World War ended. Knowing my slave ancestor as the matriarch of my family, she had raised my mother, who was born 1894 and died in 1995 at 101. And I was born in 1921, which means that I was 27, as I say, when my slave ancestor died. And all of that American history, that great American narrative, from slavery through Reconstruction, through Plessy v. Ferguson and the First World War and Lindbergh and Amelia Earhart and the Great Depression and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the assassinations of the Kennedys and Emmett Till and Trayvon Martin and the moon landing and the Mars probe all happened within the lifetime of three women who were adults together. That is mind-boggling, the fact that I bring that history to this park, that I was a seated guest in January of 2009 with a picture of my great-grandmother in my breast pocket watching the inauguration of the first African-American president in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial, whose life was contemporary with that of my great-grandmother's. That is what I bring to this park. And I think that that narrative is something that this entire nation has gone through, that that trajectory of my life, which went from being that young woman of 18 with only two chances for employment to becoming the interpretive park ranger that I am now with full privilege. I think that that's enough to build a park around.
You would think that was enough to build several parks around, I have to be honest with you, Betty. So let me talk about the segregated union, as you were talking about, a Boilermakers union. What exactly does that mean? What did you do in your day-to-day work?
It means that the shipyards had to be unionized. That was mandated at that time under Henry Kaiser. But it did mean that Henry Kaiser had to go with the social system that was in place at the time. And black and white workers were segregated. That's remained true even after the war. The unions were not racially integrated until the 50s and 60s. At that time, the unions were a drop box into which black workers were filled without a vote, either in the international body or in the union itself. We simply paid union dues. Our records were kept by the unions, but that was it.
So what you and then eventually transitioned into work with the civil rights and political movements of the 1960s, what brought you to the civil rights movement?
Well, there were lots and lots of years here.
Right.
The civil rights movement was something that evolved along with me. I didn't enter the civil rights movement formally until the 60s, actually. So that those 20 years between the time of the Second World War and the civil rights movement of the 60s was something that was a period of great confusion for people like me. It was formalized during the 60s when we actually had devices, had systems with which to become involved with that civil rights union.
What do you mean by a period of great confusion for you?
Because I grew up in California. I grew up from the age of six through the time that I became a union clerk in that union hall at 20, so that I pretty much grew up as a second generation Californian, not having grown up under racial segregation, under a system that was formally racial segregation, though of course racial prejudice existed. It was by gentleman's agreement. It was not encoded into the laws as it was in the South, so that I was spared that kind of experience growing up and was introduced to it formally only after the black migration into the defense zones under Roosevelt's arsenal of democracy.
Well, explain to me then what brought you to the civil rights movement. For a person who, I mean, this confusion eventually led to you deciding to get involved. What was it? Was it then participating in a segregated union, or was it something that you saw in your personal life?
No, it would have been a combination of many things. It would have been the fact that I experienced segregation, major segregation, during the period of the Second World War, but also that I spent some years after the war, built a home in the suburbs in California where we were the only family in the Diablo Valley for a long time, the family of color, where we experienced great rejection, actually death threats, because we had dared to move into properties that were essentially white. Because the GI Bill, which enabled the construction of the suburbs throughout the country around all of the boom towns, were whites only. Blacks could not follow. And because my husband and I had grown up in California, we simply didn't realize that. We built a home where we were not wanted. And so that, I think, radicalized me politically, so that led into the 60s, where I actually could identify with the Black Revolution and the unfulfilled dreams that were promised by our founding documents.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Betty Reed Soskin. She is the oldest National Park Ranger in the United States, and she works as a ranger at the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historical Park. And you were actually involved in the planning committee for the historical park. What did you bring to that, to the planning for this, especially considering your unique perspective on Rosie the Riveter and that heritage?
Well, we kind of have to go back. When I came in as a clerk in that Jim Crow Union Hall, it was 2 years after I'd graduated from high school as a young woman of color, with only two opportunities for employment open to me. I could have worked in agriculture, or I could have been a domestic servant. I was a child of the servants' class. Our parents, our uncles, our fathers were the red caps, the porters, the waiters, the janitors. Our mothers were the domestic servants for white people's homes and raising their children. That would have been my fate. But when I returned to Richmond, California during the Second World War, it was as In 13 years ago, I came back to Richmond, this time as a field representative for a member of the California State Assembly, after raising four kids to adulthood, after having lots and lots of lives and lots of decades. I came back here as a field representative for two members of the California State Assembly. I was in a satellite office doing constituency work, helping to determine what kind of legislation might be needed out of the five cities of West County over which we sat. And in that role, because one of the sites in our scattered site parks was owned by the state of California, there was a seat at the planning table for the state, and I was in that seat. But you have to understand that when I came back to California, it was under a very different America. The 70 years of social change that were sort of motivated by what happened here during 1941 to 1945 had produced a nation that allowed for me to have that role, and I came to the parks as a consultant.
So there, you're there in some of those initial meetings on planning the Rosie the Riveter site.
Yes.
How much?
And I'm the only person of color who could recognize the scattered sites that define this park as being sites of racial segregation, because what gets remembered is a function of who's in the room doing the remembering. And I'm the only person in the room who had any reason to remember that.
How was that information welcomed? I can imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because those other planners in that room were all graduates of Jim Henson's Meppets. They were all graduates of Sesame Street. They were graduates of Mr. Rogers, and they knew that it wasn't easy being green. And they were open to being reminded. And I was open to learning what I had not learned during the war.
However, for many African American families, when they visit a historic site, unless it's specifically related to either the Civil Rights Movement or maybe the Civil War, they often are mostly white history in the United States. That's often the experience of many African Americans or any person of color, be they Latino or Asian American or anything else.
So, absolutely. Generally, history tends to knock off the top scorers and the bottom scorers as much as we do in the scoring the Olympics, and we go with a generic middle, and that generic middle is white.
You actually been blogging as well about some of this history and other things since 2003, which frankly also blows my mind. What got you into blogging? You said you started it because you were learning to see yourself in context. Are you talking
well,
about...
Well, I started blogging originally because I was doing a family history project, genealogy, and the frustration of trying to trace the women whose names changed along the way. I never could find them after a generation or so. And I wanted to leave a record of my life for my children and my grandchildren. It started out just to be something, a record, that they would know what happened on my tenure. I did it because it was an easy way to process life as it went by eventually. Now I've been doing it for about 10 years. I hadn't realized I would be doing that. And now it serves to process life as it occurs, and I like doing it.
And you've said that you realized at some point you'd outlived your rage.
Yes, I've outlived my rage without losing my passion, and I think that's a gift. I think that that rage made it possible for me to live through lots and lots of trauma over those times. It served me well when I was younger. I don't seem to need it now. But the passion remains, and I think that that serves me well, too.
Did your mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, did they also outlive their rage, do you think?
I'm not sure, because I don't know that the world they lived in is comparable to the one that I live in. The one that I live allows expression to these feelings that theirs did not. We have so many ways to share these life experiences. I would guess that my great-grandmother outlived her rage, because I don't think she would have survived had she had to incorporate the experience of slavery and carry it forward. Though it's interesting to me that one of her grandchildren, just one generation or two generations out of slavery, was the president of Texas Southern University. This meant that she must have imparted lots and lots of wisdom from her limited sources.
Well, since you mentioned the word wisdom, and since this segment is called Wisdom Watch, I wonder if you would impart some of yours to us, having gone in the footprints of so many incredible surviving women and strong women, and you yourself being just an amazing survivor and historical record, at least, of the American history. What possibly would you tell somebody? I mean, what do you tell a young person when they come to you at your historical site and say, what's your best advice?
I think that things that I have discovered just in the past maybe 5 years is that there are conflicting truths, that there be a place on the planet where my truth can coexist with the truths of other realities that other people have experienced over time, and that they can do that in peace, is a value that I think I would not have been able to recognize even 5 years ago. And I'm able to deal with that as long as my truth can coexist in the same place with those of others. I don't any longer expect the world to be as cohesive as I once did. I think now that every generation has to recreate democracy because it will never stay fixed, that one of our rights is to be wrong, and that that's a protected right. One of our rights is to be a bigot. One of our rights is to recognize that the only thing that corrects a bad idea is a good idea. And those came with age.
I could keep talking to you forever, except that I can't. That's Betty Reed Soskin, a park ranger with the Rosie the Riveter World War II National Historical Park in Richmond, California. She joined us from Berkeley, California. Betty, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just ahead, racking up 8 Grammy nominations could tempt a musician to rest on her laurels, but singer-songwriter Ledisi still pushes to connect with her fans.
All I can do is create music to empower and uplift, and hopefully it will reach more than just old school. It can reach new school and everyone.
Ledisi joins us to talk about her latest album, The Truth. That's just ahead on Tell Me More. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that identity thieves target bank and savings accounts of victims. Learn more at LifeLock.com, code NPR. From John and Catherine Debs, in support of NPR's new global headquarters and production center in Washington, D.C. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering genomic testing that may reveal other treatment options for individual cancer patients, at cancercenter.com, and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Michael McFaul recently tweeted, "Current conflict with Russia is a tragedy for me, not good for U.S. or Russia." McFaul was the U.S. ambassador to Russia for 2 years and left at the end of February. He was considered the architect of Obama's Russia policy. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with McFaul about the crisis in Ukraine and his own interactions with the Putin government. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life.
Oh my God!
One thing I really like in a radio story.
What's back there?
Nothing. It looks empty. No, there's someone living back there.
He's a mystery.
I'm not going back there.
There's somebody's hair. There's a head in there.
There's a shrunken head right there.
Mysteries explained each week. This American Life.
It's Santa Claus. Resident Evil.
Saturday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 6 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square in Urbana, a lifestyle center which includes unique and independently owned specialty shops and restaurants like Pieto and Pieto 2, Tang Dynasty, and The Great Impasta.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. Our friends at All Things Considered have been collecting stories of moments when people's careers took off. It's called My Big Break. They recently spoke to Dr. Samson Davis, who grew up in the rough parts of Newark, New Jersey. He talked about how doing a stint in juvie put his life in perspective.
Just to walk down the street, I would see drug dealers. I would see people stealing cars. I would see prostitution. I would see people using drugs. And that was my surrounding. That was my backdrop. When I was 17 and a half, committed a robbery with a group of guys from the streets, and so dumb to think about it, but we call ourselves the Robin Hood of the community. We were going to rob drug dealers and give back to the poor. When the robbery took place, we jumped out the car and walked up to them and sort of patting them down and taking things out of their pocket, I noticed another car pulled up to the scene. And literally within seconds, there was a sirens everywhere, cop cars everywhere. One of the guys that I was with, he's running past me, and you could see he look at me in my direction. I could see the fear in his face and the, you know, what was I thinking as he was being chased by the police and he was caught. So all four of us was taken off to jail. And then I remember I spent the summer between my junior year and senior year in juvenile detention with the crime that I committed. Had I been considered an adult, which was age 18, then I would have had a felony charge. And I'm quite certain I would have been given years in jail. And so when I was sitting there in that room and having moments to myself and in a cold room with a thin sheet, and I realized that if I didn't change my life around and stay focused more on the academics, that I would die on the streets. And that was my big break. When I returned to high school my senior year, that's when I made the pact with my two friends. And we made this pact that we were going to become doctors. We made this promise that we were going to figure it out. Being the first one in my family to go to college, I didn't know that I had to fill out a college application, and I had to take the bus to go to my own college interview. We made it to Seton Hall University and went on to medical school, and two of us became physicians, one became a dentist, but we all are practicing doctors in New Jersey and New York. Now, I was fortunate to come back home to my hometown of Newark, New Jersey, and practice emergency medicine in the same hospital that I was born in. I'm sitting in morning report with the rest of the doctors, and I'm looking at the board, and the board is made up of a medley of different names of patients who came in the night before who were shot, stabbed, car accidents, bar fights, you name it. And so I see the name Don Moses across the board, and I close my eyes and think, like, what are the Don Moses? I know a Don Moses, and this is the Don Moses I did the crime with, the robbery with, years ago. So I sprint down the hallway, hit the button on the wall, the double door swing open, and as I approach the room, I start to see familiar faces, and lo and behold, it was his family. He had been shot multiple times, and he had died. Literally, I had just chills throughout my body because it hit me. If I had decided to still stay down that same road, I would have been dead. I probably would have been lying right next to Don, who lost his life on the streets. To be back in Newark as the same physical being but with a different mental perspective, I feel like I went through these things in life. I never wished them on anyone, but certainly enough, if I can make it, anyone can make it.
Dr. Samson Davis, physician and author of Living and Dying in Brick City and All Things Considered, wants to hear about your big break. Send them an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. Your love life might be full of ups and downs, but every once in a while, you have to be honest about where the relationship is really going. We don't even kiss. Can't live my life like this. Time to face the truth. That's The Truth. It's the title cut from singer-songwriter Lettucey's latest album. For the past decade or so, she's picked up a global following, not to mention 8 Grammy nominations. She's on tour now and stopped by to chat with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's talk about this. Well, you know what? Actually, let's talk about 8 Grammy nominations and no Grammy win. What's that like?
Look, I'm so happy every time I'm nominated because at least I'm being recognized. Every album so far has been recognized. So I'm grateful for that. I would like to win, but You know, that's the truth. I would like to, but it'll happen when it's time. So
you've actually said that making this particular album was scary, which is surprising. You've been performing for a very long time, and this is hardly your first album coming off the presses. What made this one scary for you?
Well, it's even more personal than any of the albums. I mean, I'm talking about not being in denial anymore about a relationship that wasn't working, and it was a long relationship, and I'm putting it all out there. I usually do, but this is my love life. That's even to me, that's personal. Gaining success or wishing for success in my career and how I feel about that is another thing. I don't mind that being out there. But a personal relationship of my own, putting it all out there, that was different for me.
How does it change the way you sing something or the way you prepare something when it is that personal, as opposed to maybe a love song somebody else wrote for you and you're interpreting it?
Well, most of the songs usually I write anyway, but it's the same feeling. It's just more intense, especially every night performing that song, The Truth, because it's, oh, wow. It's like I relive the moment every time of the awakening. It's, to me, accepting the truth was an awakening, like, okay, this is it. No more denial, no more settling. This isn't working. Pack your crap and go. You know what I mean? It's like, that was hard for me. And then to put it in a song at 3 a.m. in the morning in New York City while I'm almost done with my album. This is the second to the last song, and I don't have a title of the album yet. And here we are. I'm being awakened by these words and this situation. And I started writing, and I called my executive producer, Rex. He and I executive produced Rex Rideout. I said, I have it. I have the song. I have everything. Here it is.
You called your producer before you let your significant other hear the song?
Mm-hmm, of course. And then we weren't together then. I had already did it, but I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to stay in denial and just kind of skate around it. It was no skating. And the words were so great. I mean, that first line, like a hurricane without warning, that's how you feel. Being from New Orleans, you got to get it together. Hurry up. What are we going to do?
Oh, yeah, you use hurricane and you're from New Orleans. That's a pretty powerful metaphor.
It hit home right away. So for me, there we are.
Here were you even present when he heard the song? Or did he just hear it when...
I don't know what he heard or not heard.
You don't know if he's heard it yet.
He did say it was a great album, the entire album. So, yeah. I don't think letting go is a bad thing. Sometimes that's the whole point of the truth, is letting go doesn't have to be sad love songs. Letting go doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's a good thing. We deserve happiness. And if you're in something and it started out a certain way and it ended up another way, you don't have to stay there. And that's my friend. We were better friends. The realization of that is a great feeling.
Well, let's talk about another one. And this one is entirely the other way in terms of this one feels like pure joy to me. This is I Blame
Exactly.
You.
Exactly.
Don't judge the lyrics by the title. Let's take a listen.
People keep asking about this glow I seem to have, because I'm just not the same. They say I'm walking different, talking different. It's like all of me changed. Magic is in my eyes. I can no longer hide. When they look at me, what they really see.
One of the things I really appreciate about your singing, it's been true of all your albums, is I never lose the melody. And you know what I mean? Very often.
Love you. I love
very
this lady.
Often in R&B singing, you're fully capable of putting as many ornamentations and as any other person, but I can walk away from hearing your album and actually sing the melody. I know what the melody is.
Yes.
How conscious of a choice was that in terms of style?
I love this album in particular, and all of them actually. I always focus on if you can whistle it, if you're on the bus, I want to be with you everywhere. If you're at work and you need a lifter to get through that extra 2 hours, that's what I'm thinking when I'm writing a song.
My mind is frozen, got me open off your love, can't think of no one else. I smell the roses doing poses in the mirror, you make me love.
Hi.
sometimes artists can be selfish and do what they want and
self-indulgent.
And be more expressive in an artistic way. But for me, I'm always thinking about my listener and how I can empower their lives and make them feel better. And it starts with the melody and the lyrics. It always starts everywhere, wherever I naturally go. But it could be the melody. Sometimes it's the lyrics, like the other songs were the lyrics. But I wrote that song with Claude Kelly and Chuck Harmony. We did Pieces of Me. And I told them I want something upbeat. They had ballads for me. I said, that's great. I'm not doing that this time. I want to feel good. I feel good about this change. And they saw me and they were like, you're glowing and you feel good. Yes, I want people to feel that love, even though I let go of love, I feel good about this self-love I have. And now I'm getting the love I deserve because someone's seeing that in me and want a part of that, want to be around it. And that feels good. So to me, letting go, like I said, it's a journey.
You know, I was not surprised. I think it's very audible to know that you have a background in gospel and in jazz. That's really clear to me. But I was also not surprised to find out that you had a background in classical music and in opera. And
I love opera first.
And here's how it connects back to what I was just saying, is that if you're doing, say, Baroque music or something, you have to decide where to ornament. You have to decide where to depart from the melody.
Yes.
And your music feels very intentional to me that way.
Yes, it goes with the feeling of a word, though, too, just like classical music. Where do you want to express that one feeling the most? And I'm glad I learned from that. I studied classical when I was, that was the first thing I heard on the radio. My mom was weird, gypsy, loved country, Willie Nelson, Patsy Cline, and classical music. So I would hear it on the radio and it just sound loud and ring, it rang bells, just the notes. I didn't know what they were saying, but I loved the way it made me feel. So I wanted to be loud. And my teacher's, oh no, here she comes again. So it's my favorite thing. And that's where I started. I didn't start in gospel. I learned that later when I moved to Oakland. But in New Orleans, we studied jazz and classical music. That's what I learned.
Let's hear another cut from your album. And I think it kind of reflects what we're talking about here. This one's called That Good Good.
I'm the type of woman, knows what she wanted, ain't afraid to say what I need. I want the kind of man that really understands it, ain't afraid to give it to me. Put your arms around me, like you're glad you found me, say you can't live without me. This kind of love don't come free.
So, I mean, props to you. Your pitch is exact. Your rhythm is exact. I wonder what do you hear when you listen to other pop music? And maybe sometimes fudging, or sometimes when there's other artists who don't read music, who don't study voice. What's your advice to the up-and-coming pop singers? Does it matter to have that study behind you?
It matters to me, but I don't know. I love it because I'm a studier of music. And not everyone is, and that's okay. Long as there's a, what are you trying to get across? What is your meaning? It's always about the lyrics for me first. The melody is someone else, but and the rhythm, the meaning and the rhythm. I'm always into the rhythm. I started on the drums, really, ironically. So, and then I went to voice, trying to be like my mom. My stepdad played drums, so everything's off of the beat.
Until I'm losing my cool.
I always listen for the beat and what are you trying to get across, whether it be ratchet or not ratchet. Long as it's, you know, you believe it, it's really you. That's what I'm looking for, originality, authenticity. Is that really who you are?
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Letticy about her latest album, The Truth. I wonder if you feel there's any extra obligation on for you as a R&B singer because you're an African-American woman. I wonder if you feel as though there's some need for you to be a role model.
It's so much pressure to be everyone's boxes. So the only thing I can promise to anyone is to be myself at all times. Even when I wanted to quit the business, it was because I couldn't be myself.
You took 5 years off, right?
Yeah. And I was exhausted because I didn't take it off. It just happened that way. I mean, I was exhausted from, I was ready to quit because I couldn't be me. Everyone wanted me to be a certain size or look a certain way and I or sing a certain way. And I came into the industry being myself. I wanted to stay that way. And when I signed with my label, I said, I have to be me. I know my audience. I know who I am. Allow me to be me. They're not, they never changed me, never told me what to do. They've supported me since I've been in it. So, and here we are, me being me. That's all I can promise to anyone. As far as being a role model, I'm not perfect. And I display my imperfections on my recordings. All I can do is create music to empower and uplift, and hopefully it will reach more than just old school. It can reach new school and everyone. I'm trying to get everyone involved in the beauty of our music, whether it be jazz, R&B, pop, whatever I do. I just want to uplift, and that's all I can promise. But my life, I'm not perfect. I'm so not, I'm far from it.
Lettucey is a Grammy-nominated singer and songwriter. Her latest album, The Truth, is available now. She joined us here in our studios in Washington, D.C., in the midst of her tour. Thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We couldn't let you go without a little more music from Lettucey's album, The Truth. Here is Like This.
Wanna be with you, you singing someone else's song. And all the stuff you did before I came along. I'm not the one, we can't be one like this.
And that's our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.